Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the thrice weekly Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thank you for queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on June 5th of 2011 under the headline Holy Roller Cult Ended with Murder, Suicide, and Insanity. Here we go. In the autumn of 1904, F. Edmund Creffield was sentenced to 2 years in prison. As a practical matter, though, the sentence might as well have been death. When Creffield emerged from prison after serving his term, it was a completely different world that awaited for him outside. And by different, I do not mean better. Creffield, founder of the most hardcore, quote-unquote, holy roller church in history, had been convicted of adultery for having sex with one of his female followers, 23-year-old Donna Mitchell Starr. He told the court it was part of a God-ordered purification ritual. It still isn't known if he thus purified any other women in his cult, but everybody outside his secretive little group instantly assumed that he had. By the time the adultery charge was made, nearly all the men had left the Bride of Christ Church, leaving only Creffield and one other man as leaders of a flock of exclusively women. Women who, following Creffield's instructions, had cut off all relations with their, quote, infidel husbands and friends and children. Now they were locked away from their loved ones, out of the community's sight, having placed themselves under the authority of a man who, as it now appeared, saw nothing wrong with adultery. And remember, the cult was rumored to believe in staying naked all the time. This rumor was almost certainly groundless and based on the perceived inadequacy, by Edwardian-era standards, of the simple garment believers wore, basically a bathrobe. But most people believed it, and it was definitely a factor. To outsiders, Creffield's flock was looking more and more like a harem, and less like a congregation. The husbands of women in Creffield's flock were starting to consider themselves not just cut off from marital relations, but cuckolded to boot. Older brothers were assuming that their little sisters had been sexually initiated. Men, at least three, probably more, started buying guns and making plans to use them. The first attempt on Creffield's life happened in Yaquina City, near Newport. Creffield had returned to Corvallis after leaving jail, just long enough to collect his scattered flock back together and lead them out of town. As had Moses so many years before, he was going to lead his people into the wilderness, a patch of unimproved woodland near Waldport on the coast, and God would take care of them there. Among the women in Creffield's flock at the time he went to prison were Cora Hartley and her daughter Sophia. When Creffield was locked away, the two of them came home to Cora's husband, Lewis Hartley, with whom they'd had nothing to do after joining the church. He was, after all, an unbeliever, and believers were not supposed to consort with the putatively damned. Lewis was obviously not happy when Creffield, fresh from the slammer, strolled into town and called for his former flock to come follow him into the wilderness. Cora and Sophia answered the call immediately and started getting ready to go. When the two of them left town on T. Edginton Hogg's railroad line to Yaquina City and Newport to join their prophet by the sea, Lewis secretively followed. When he arrived at Yaquina City, Lewis realized he'd lost their trail. The two women had spotted him en route and got off early at Toledo to shake him. So he boarded a ferry to Newport and tried to find a judge who would order Creffield's arrest. None would. So Creffield left the courthouse and stepped into a sporting goods store. And with a brand new .32 caliber revolver in his pocket, Hartley now started searching not for his family, but for Creffield. Eventually, not finding his quarry in Newport, Hartley boarded the ferry and returned to Yaquina City. And as the ferry he was on was docking, he saw another ferry just getting ready to depart, with his wife and daughter standing on the stern, with Creffield. Hartley leaped from his ferry as it pulled into the dock, and raced to the other just as it pulled away from the slip. He drew his revolver and opened fire on Creffield, who stood on the ferry facing him a few yards away. Five clicks rang out. The bullets Hartley had bought with the pistol were the wrong type for the gun. He'd loaded the rimfire pistol with centerfire ammo. As a side note, it's extremely likely that the person who sold Mr. Hartley that gun made that mistake on purpose, fearing that he was going to take it and try to kill somebody with it. If that's the case, it worked great. Although he put a good face on it at the time, Creffield seems to have taken this lesson to heart. From then on, he was a hard man to find, always on the move. He led his flock into the wilderness camp, but didn't stay long. When Hartley returned with a Winchester rifle to try again, he found his prey long gone. Over the following few months, Creffield's itinerant lifestyle frustrated at least one other would-be assassin, probably more. But eventually, Creffield ended up in Seattle. And it was in that city, at 7:10 a.m. on May 7, 1906, as he was walking down the street with Maud, his wife, that a fellow named George Mitchell walked up behind him with a pocket pistol and put a bullet into the back of his head. Mitchell was the brother of two of Creffield's most devoted followers, Esther Mitchell and Donna Mitchell Starr. The latter, you'll remember, was the woman he was convicted of adulterously purifying. Mitchell, after the police arrived, quietly handed over his pistol. Quote,
"I have only done my duty,"
he told the officers, according to police reports.
"I came here to kill that man, as he ruined my two sisters, and I have completed my work."
The trial was something of a landmark for Seattle. There was widespread sympathy for Mitchell. For all practical purposes, his defense rested on something known as the unwritten law, the one that says it's okay for a man to perpetrate what you might call an honor killing on the fellow who's defiled his wife or sister. When the trial concluded, the jury found Mitchell not guilty. This in spite of the fact that he had admitted in open court to an action that fit the description of premeditated murder with remarkable precision. Although the smart money had been on a not guilty by reason of insanity verdict, the word when it came was just plain not guilty. Mitchell was a free man. In finding this way, without invoking an insanity defense that would result in Mitchell spending some time in an asylum, the members of the jury no doubt thought they were doing him a favor. They were gravely mistaken. A few days later, Mitchell met up with his sister Esther in a railroad depot for what other family members hoped would be a reconciliation of sorts. Instead, it turned into another execution. Esther shot her brother in the back of the head with a pocket pistol in almost exactly the same way he'd gunned down Creffield. In the aftermath of this shocker, the newspaper reporters really wanted Esther to tell them that God had told her to avenge Creffield's death, or that somehow a religious frenzy had made her do it. Instead, she told them two things. First, she said she was doing exactly what her brother had done. The law was inadequate to the task of punishing a murderer, as evidenced by the fact that he'd been acquitted despite having admitted in open court that he did it. This was pretty similar to George's claim that he'd had to shoot Creffield because the law wouldn't keep him away from his sisters. Secondly, she pointed out that George had done exactly what he'd accused Creffield of doing, branded her as a fornicator. She insisted that Creffield had never had sex with her, and by making the statement that he'd killed Creffield because Creffield had, quote, ruined his sisters, George had, in effect, ruined his sisters. At her trial, Esther Mitchell refused to try to claim insanity. The state forced it on her anyway and committed her to an asylum. A few years later, out of the asylum and staying at a family friend's place, she took a massive dose of strychnine and died, following the example of the widowed Maud Hurt Creffield, who'd killed herself in the same manner shortly after the trial. Even water, in excessive quantities, is a deadly poison. Perhaps the same is true of what Creffield and his faithful followers would call the water of life. Key sources in this story have included works by Jim Phillips and Rosemary Gardner, Stuart Holbrook and Brian Booth, and Lewis Thompson. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do. Visuals that go with today's show can be found at offbeatoregon.com, where you will also find full citations to the sources for this story. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Got an idea for a show I should do or just want to say hi? Drop me a line at fj@offbeatoregon.com or ping me on Twitter at @offbeatoregon or send a message through the Facebook page at facebook.com/oregon.1859. Also, do let me know if you're ever going to be in Corvallis with time for a cup of coffee or a pint of Hammerhead and an inclination to talk about Oregon history. Fresh episodes of Offbeat Oregon History come your way around 6 a.m. every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. So if you're looking forward to the next one, well, you haven't got long to wait. Until then, go fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.